Good evening, everybody. James McKenna here with my Science Hour. This is for June 27th, 2024. And tonight's main science topics, I'll be talking a little bit more about Saturn's rings. It's a topic I've been covering over the last number of weeks. But tonight's really main science topic, I'm going to be talking about weather on Earth and how it relates to other planets. So I'll be talking about Jupiter, which is every 13 months we have an occurrence, which I coined the term Jupiter winds. So I'm going to give you a little forewarning that pre-Christmas time will be a bit windy. So if you like the wind, if you like to fly kites, and wintertime is just as good a time to fly kites as summertime, although you have to put on more clothes, especially if you're in the northern climates. But anyway, we'll be talking about that. I'll be talking about the hurricane season, which is just beginning, and aurora season, which is coming up in August, and why does all this happen at this time of year? And the real reason is because of something called the August return current sheet. And that's kind of a broad term, but basically there's an electrical circuit in the solar system, something that standard scientists don't know anything about because they don't look. I don't know what they're thinking, but just something I discovered a long time ago is that the sun puts out a lot more energy in terms of electrical energy than it does in light energy. It's a tremendous amount of energy. Now, electrical energy, we can tap into that. In fact, a guy named Nikola Tesla was tapping into that. He found a way to do that, and of course, they shut him down. I rediscovered what he was doing in my work, and that was decades ago. I published a book called Atlantis to Tesla, The Colburn Connection. And basically, at his Wardenclyffe Tower and at his Colorado Springs facility, he was gathering atmospheric electricity, but it wasn't like a broad scale. It was what I call tunneling through the atmosphere. And the way you do that is similar to what lightning does. Lightning finds a very direct path and then follows it to ground. And what Tesla was doing he had a mechanism, and I'll just explain it briefly. He had the electronic circuit looked like this. There was a Schmitt trigger, and all that is an opening and closing with a DC battery on one side. And it's not like your car battery, but a big, big DC battery. And so what happens when you close the points on a battery, basically creating a short circuit temporarily, that causes a huge rush of current. And what Tesla did is he used what is known as a Tesla coil. I'm not sure if that's what he called it, but it was basically a transformer with a very high ratio of coils. In other words, you take what is already a very high pulse and you amplify that thousands and thousands of times. And then there's also a resonance in that circuit. But basically, if you do this at the resonant frequency of this set of coils, you then develop a extremely high voltage, plus and minus AC voltage. And if you attach this then to a device that's up in the sky, that's what happens is the Earth's atmosphere is what is known as a dielectric. And the dielectrics, the interesting thing about the molecules in a dielectric, excuse me, the interesting thing is that the little atoms have a dipole. In other words, there's a slight separation of charge in the molecule. And so they start flipping in unison with this alternating field that was developed by Tesla. And so if you add more and more power, this is like a radio signal, and you add more and more power to this signal, then eventually you can drill a hole vertically up through the atmosphere and discharge all the way to the real power source that is up in the ionosphere. He was able to do that at Wardenclyffe, and he was able to do that on a substantial scale at Colorado Springs, to the point that one night he blew out miles and miles away. It was like, I think, about 12 miles away, a power station, a power generating station, and they made him pay for it. But he had lights. This is interesting. This a very interesting issue. He had lights scattered throughout the desert around the Colorado Springs facility, and basically it amounted to a light, an electric light bulb, with probes that go down in the ground. And so basically the current would come through the ground, up one wire, through the bulb, down the other wire, and out into the ground again. And so there was a alternating electric field moving through the ground, and he knew what the resonant frequency was of the ground. And so he was able to transmit electricity through the ground and gaining that electricity from the atmosphere. Okay, so, and this relates also, interestingly enough, to my discovery of the Nazca lines. And what are those all about? Well, they're fractal antenna array. Not just fractal antennas, but a fractal antenna array out in the middle of the Peruvian desert. But be that as it may, the reason I started talking about this was because in this electrical circuit that's in our solar system, and that is part of Earth's portion of that circuit. But the way this circuit begins is the sun, our sun, has an excess current of protons in the solar wind, and that solar wind effectively brushes all of the molecular material, atomic and molecular material, that's really, there's a lot of it in our solar system, sweeps it out and pushes it back into a big cloud that surrounds our solar system out beyond the orbit of Pluto. And that sets up a capacitor with the positive cloud out there and the sun, leaving the sun with a net negative charge relative to this electric circuit. And the reason I'm saying this is because you cannot, in an electric circuit that's powered like this, you can't continue doing this forever. You have to have a return current sheet to complete the circuit. That return current sheet happens to be passing through the solar system where Earth passes through in the month of August. That's why we have the maximum tornado season, hurricane season, aurora season, other activity in the month of August. And it starts this activity because the current sheet, we're moving into it as early as June and as late as November. That's how broad this current sheet can be. So it's really something that would be difficult to detect. And just to mention also that the detection of voltages and currents in outer space is something you cannot do with a single spacecraft because there's no ground. If you go out to your automobile and you say, well, I want to measure the voltage on the battery in my car, you go out and you lift up the hood and you take a voltage meter, and there's two probes. There's a red one and there's a black one. And you set it to the 12 or the 15 volt range on your voltmeter, and you put the red terminal or the red wire onto the positive charge, and you put the black one on the negative pole of the battery. The red one goes on the positive pole of the battery, marked with a little plus, and then it'll give you the voltage reading on your battery. But you need two probes. By definition, a voltage is a potential difference, and its difference is in terms of spatial difference, a measurement of distance. And so you can have a voltage, like if you measured a little 1.5 volt battery that you might use in a flashlight or your electric toothbrush, that if you measured that on the plus side, put the red terminal, the red wire on the plus side, the negative side would have the black wire from your voltage meter, and you would measure a volt and a half if it was fully charged, or maybe just a little bit more. But voltage is measured in terms of spatial distance. So how do you do that with a spacecraft? There's no ground. If you plug an electric circuit into the wall, usually most circuits today have that little third pin, that little round one that goes in, that's a ground. But one of the leads on the circuit, on the plug that goes in the wall, one of them is what you call hot, that's where the signal is, and the other one is neutral. And so that's basically equivalent to ground in most cases, but that gets a little bit complicated. I don't want to go into electricity as it's put in the house. That's rather complicated. But anyway, the point is that you in a situation in outer space, you do not have the ability to measure voltages. And oddly enough, if you have a spacecraft, they do charge up and they become negatively charged. And this has been known about since, oh, when I first started in dealing with the space stuff in back in the Cornell days in the late 1970s. People had already published that spacecraft were charging. And then, of course, that became politically incorrect to say that. But they had measured it, and they knew it was that the spacecraft were charging. But the thing that happens is that the spacecraft, say it charges up to a negative potential, it has excess charge of electrons. Then, as the electrons come to go in the particle detectors that might be on the satellite, they're repelled, and so you don't count as many electrons. And so it turns out that once the spacecraft becomes charged and the charge is stable, it counts the same number of protons as electrons, and it'll always do that. It'll charge up to a level and then always see the same number of charged particles, positive and negative. And that's why astronomers, astrophysicists, space scientists don't understand that that outer space has electrical conditions, because you can't measure it with a single spacecraft. Very simple. This is not rocket scientists. In fact, when I debated Dr. David Morrison on the Coast to Coast AM show, it was a pretty widely advertised debate. It got a lot of attention. A lot of people were viewing, and especially NASA scientists, etc. I won the debate by a call-in vote. But Dr. David Morrison did not understand the principle of spacecraft charging, and that you cannot. He said, "Oh, well, we've measured the charges in space, and it's always the same." Well, that's why. That's why. But so people don't believe in it because you can't measure it with a single spacecraft. There are ways to measure it. So all they see are magnetic fields, but magnetic fields don't simply self-generate in outer space. They need electrical currents in a plasma environment to generate magnetic fields. They need electric current. Okay, so anyway, that might be getting a little complicated. I'm going to jump back to the topic of weather. So the weather down here on planet Earth, you get in your car, it's raining, get in your car, it's windy, you get in your car, there's a tornado in the next county. All of that weather, all of it, is the subject is related to electric fields. If we didn't have electric fields, none of that weather would exist at all. And I start out my weather book, the Principia Meteorologia, the Physics of Sun, Earth, Weather. I start out by saying that if we did not have electrical conditions in the atmosphere of Earth, we would not have hurricanes, we wouldn't have tornadoes, we wouldn't have lightning, we wouldn't have auroras, we would not have the clouds. We wouldn't have clouds. Imagine that if we didn't have vertical electric fields. That's one of the essential aspects of cloud formation, is the vertical electric field. Okay, and this is true on all the other planets, Jupiter, Venus. Venus is interesting because it does not have a magnetic field, so you can see the X-rays on the sunward side of Venus, not on the night side. And it's the same situation as with a comet. And that's because Venus is very much acting like a comet. It's a discharging the solar capacitor, and we brush through the tail of Venus every time Venus has an inferior conjunction, and it causes the flu, of all things. This is in the medical literature. So I'm just telling you what scientists have known about for a long time. And the flu is nothing more than relatively small particles. They're organic particles made up of the building blocks of DNA, not DNA itself. They don't get quite that big. But what happens is when you breathe these in, and you'll notice that especially in the springtime, if it's been dry for a while, then all of a sudden there's a rain, everybody gets the flu. Well, what the flu is your body reacting to this stuff that's foreign to your body, and your body's immune system is kicking in the symptoms of the flu, which make you feel like kind of crap, excuse the expression, but that's your body's immune system reacting to get rid of this stuff. And so anyway, that's the primary cause of flu. And so the Venus flu, the Venus inferior conjunction flu, which was first discovered by the Chinese in the 1200s. They noticed the association between the annual flu — it's a little more than annual, it's every about year and a half or so — with the inferior conjunction of Venus. Okay, so back to Earth's weather. The reason we have tornadoes, hurricanes, cyclonic storms, typhoons, water spouts, all of these events, and including tornadoes on the surface of the sun that race across the sun. By the way, that's why the Russian scientists became very interested in my work back in the 90s, is because they were the thing that they didn't understand a lot of phenomena that were dealing with atmospheric electricity. They had been to the Tunguska event. They knew that that was an electrical event of some kind. They didn't really understand it. But the thing that kind of really puzzled them when they saw tornadoes on the sun, that predated the NASA so-called discovery by 10 years. And so they wanted to know what was going on, so they got a hold of me. And so we had a very long collaboration, actually. In the length of time of years, dealing with them and on a daily basis translating my work and then teaching them about how these things work, where the electric fields came from. But they understood there was a vertical electric field. They didn't know where it came from. So at any rate, the tornadoes on the sun, when they observed those, that was like the, okay, gloves are off, we don't know what's going on. So they came to me and asked me, and that began this collaboration. And I explained to them what the tornadoes were, and they're the same cause as tornadoes on Earth. And you also see them on like other planets, like Jupiter. You see cyclonic storms on Saturn. Around the South Pole, especially of Saturn, you see big cyclonic storms, exactly like Earth's South Pole, where it has cyclonic storms, sometimes six of them in a tight hexagonal bundle. You see that on Earth, and you see it in Saturn's atmosphere, which confounds scientists because they can't figure out what's going on. But these are all caused by electrical currents, vertical electric fields in their atmosphere, and then the currents, electrical currents, and then the spinning is caused by the Coriolis force. And like I say, you can look at the South Pole of Earth and see these same exact storm systems. But they're all caused by the same situation. They are caused by the vertical electric field discharging, and typically through cloud systems. And so we're heading into this season, and that is enhanced by the August return current sheet. It's not the only factor. You have new moon passing, you have alignment with other planets, you have, and this is where I'll get into next December, talking about Jupiter. You have comets, and typically small comets can cause great effects on Earth weather because if they're aligned with Earth. And by the way, the Tunguska event, where this vast explosion that blew down hundreds of square miles around this epicenter point, was an electrical discharge from a small passing comet. And the airburst, which was very close to the ground, because the way the trees blew out, the explosion was very close to the ground. And ultimately, there was nothing on the ground. There's no particulate matter left over from some kind of a solid object coming in to Earth's atmosphere. And so basically, there's no remnant on the ground. There would be all this, whatever the meteorite had, or comet nucleus, whatever it was made of, there would be remnants of that. And it would be embedded into the trees, for example, which are still there, the trees that were knocked down in the explosion. And there's nothing there. There's no remnant. And these scientists went out there looking and, of course, found nothing, and so they were puzzled as to what caused that. So that was another reason for getting a hold of me and talking about my work. And that's happened many times throughout my career, where people would not understand something. In fact, that happened with the topic of Jupiter winds. The U.S. military, had a satellite that they put up, and it was just to measure plasmas and electric currents. And one day it got labeled with a huge electron current. And they realized it was coming from Jupiter. And so anyway, they got a hold of me and said, "What's going on here? What's this electrical current between Earth and Jupiter?" So the end result was that it is an electrical cross-solar system electrical discharge. And that's what Velikovsky was talking about. So the Tier 1 military people know that Velikovsky was right about many of the things he was looking at. The ancients talk about these things, the lightning bolts across the heaven from Jupiter to Mars, from Jupiter to the comet Venus. And they know that all of that's true, but they have to maintain the public ignorant. And that's where the people, the Tier 2 people, the Tier 3 people, outreach people that pile all of this garbage science on the public, that's where they come in. And it's all by design. It's all by design. So anyway, Jupiter has a very large discharge of the solar capacitor. And so when Earth's discharge and Jupiter's discharge connect, then Earth gets a royal dose of electrons, and it creates what I call the Jupiter winds. The winds that now, for example, you can put this on your calendar, starting around December 1st, this coming December 1st, the actual date of the opposition of Jupiter, which is the time when Jupiter is perfectly linearly, optically aligned with Earth and the Sun, is December 7th. And so you go a few days before and a few days afterwards, usually for a period of about 10 years. So let's say December 2nd, December 3rd, somewhere in that time frame. And it can vary, but typically it's pretty close. So the December 1st, 2nd, 3rd, somewhere in that time frame, up until December 10th, 11th, 12th, somewhere in that time frame. But certainly during the 7th of December, you can expect some straight line winds, and that's how they typically come down. You would think, given something like that, that they would be a lot of tornadoes, hurricanes, etc. And that's usually not how they are manifested. They are typically straight line winds, and that just blow for days, days and days and days. That's typical of what I call the Jupiter winds. So I can expect that around December. And that's every 13 months. It's kind of like clockwork. And the thing about straight line winds especially if you're on the ocean, they can be horrific. They can get up to 50, 60, 70 miles an hour. And for small craft especially, can pose a lot of danger. But I'm not sure, well, and this is worldwide, so you could potentially be in the tropics during that time frame, and not a good time to go out on the ocean. So just keep that in mind. In fact, I have to make a mental note myself about that. Okay, so back to August, and the once again, we have the auroras, the peak of the aurora season. We have the, and of course, these phenomena can happen at any time. You can have hurricanes any time of year, but August is the peak time. And like I say, there's many other factors. So the auroras, what are auroras? They are basically charged particle storms from the sun that come in, and they follow the magnetic field lines down into the north and southern regions of the planet. The other planets have them too. Jupiter has them all the time. And there is actually a ring current of auroras going on Earth all the time. At the North Pole, you can see on the, for example, the ultraviolet satellite images of Earth that are there, you know, constantly the data is coming in. And they're typically heavier on one side of the ring than the other. And these things rotate around the northern polar region within the Arctic Circle, and they're there all the time. So if you lived up on the Arctic Circle, you would be seeing auroras every night. If you lived in Norway, very far north Canada, up in the Northwest Territory, Hudson Bay, you would be seeing them most nights of the year. You would see something. When I was a kid growing up in the upper Midwest, there was a tale of Paul Bunyan. Paul Bunyan was a woodsman, this giant guy with Babe the Blue Ox. And supposedly the auroras were Paul, because he was a lumberjack, so he had this red lumberjack shirt, one of those plaid wool shirts, you know. I don't know if they even sell those anymore. They probably do somewhere. You can get them at L.L. Bean's or one of those places, if those are still in business. But so Paul Bunyan wore his suspendered jeans and this red shirt. And then, of course, a lumberjack cap. And Babe the Blue Ox was blue. And so they would be fighting and playing up at the North Pole, and that was the idea, that their wrestling and jostling around would cause the reflection, and that was the cause of the Northern Lights. And of course, the indigenous people had their story too, when in actuality it was due to storms from the sun, particle storms. So let's go through the anatomy of a hurricane. And the majority of hurricanes are in the Atlantic Ocean. So what happens is, during the summer months, especially the summer months in the Northern Hemisphere, the storms, the cumulonimbus clouds form over Africa, around the equator, just a little bit north of the equator, and they track westerly. They track westerly, and as they're discharging the vertical electric field, the lightning, etc., is going through the clouds. It was basically a discharge between the upper atmosphere and ground. And all along that path, where they're moving westerly in Central Africa, they have a ground. As soon as those cloud systems move off into the Atlantic, over the Atlantic Ocean, they no longer have the electrical connection to ground. So that electricity ionizes the air at the surface of the ocean, and around the equator, the ionosphere is negatively charged. There are bands around the Earth. There are actually, 5 bands total. The equatorial band is primarily electrons moving in the westerly direction. So what happens is that the ions then want to follow the current path going up the, and typically the highest cloud is where the eye forms, the eye of the hurricane. And so that connects, like a finger sticking up, connects with the vertical electric field. The ions form a current sheet, and as they move up, they start to spin, and they clear out that center eye, what we call the eye of the hurricane, and that's what is powering the hurricane. So then it moves westerly, and that's due to the electrical current moving in Earth's magnetic field. That's why the hurricanes move west, is because of the electric field. And so then as they build up steam over the Atlantic Ocean, that discharge increases. And this is where storm manipulation comes in, by the way, is what we developed with the Russian scientists was the mechanism for controlling hurricanes and dragging them out of harm's way. Well, when the military of the U.S. got a hold of it, of course, they weaponized it, and it's been happening ever since. The late 1990s, early 2000s, is when the U.S. military picked up on that and started weaponizing it, something that they tend to do with everything. Okay, so that's the anatomy of a hurricane. And now, one of the most interesting things I've ever seen is the phenomenon of waterspouts. I was walking on a Caribbean beach one day, nice, beautiful, sunny day, a little bit hazy, but not overcast. No clouds, just hazy, which is typical of the Caribbean. And so walking along a beach, and I look out over the Caribbean Sea, and my goodness, there are two, not one, but two waterspouts moving parallel to one to the other, and moving across the ocean. Oh my goodness. And the thing is, when you see this, you realize that there's some, you know, is this magic? What's going on? In physics, there's always a reason for something. But there again, it's the vertical electric field. And so the cyclonic movement is because of what is known as the Coriolis force. It's the same effect that if you have a bathtub, and especially in the old kind of bathtubs where you just had a plug. You pulled the plug out and there was a drain and there was no filter, there was no screen, nothing. Just the water went down and pretty soon it started spinning. And that's the Coriolis force. That's what causes the vortex motion in a drain. Well, this is the same except the drain is moving vertically upwards where the charged particles are moving. The ionized air at the base of this thing starts moving up the electrical column, and because they're moving up, just like water going down a drain, these are ions going up a funnel, and so they start to spin in a characteristic direction. And so then the end result is a water spout. There's no clouds, you really don't see anything. You just see this spout moving along. And they've been known to pick up, say, for example, a school of fish and then throw the fish all over the ocean. There's stories of Japanese fishermen out there in the ocean. All of a sudden, it's raining fish. Like, where did those come from? Well, off in the distance someplace, there were water spouts pulling the fish up out of the water and then just throwing them. One of the most interesting phenomena that I've seen, and I've seen recently some people have posted these online, are electrical discharges above volcanoes, especially active volcanoes. But I have in one of my books, I don't remember which one, either the weather book or Atlantis to Tesla, I've got a picture of a tornado coming out of Mount Vesuvius over in Italy. And the tornado is just up above, right in the cone area, spinning. And it's a beautiful blue sky, sunny day, no clouds, nothing that would make you think, oh, there's there's the cause of a tornado there. Perfectly blue sky, perfectly clear, and there's a tornado coming out the top cone of the volcano. And what really causes tornadoes is the same thing, the electrical vertical field and an electrical current discharging that field. So The discharge of atmosphere, the discharge of plasmas, is very important to understand. When you look at a regular tornado, there are all kinds of videos, especially when the videos were taken at night, of tornadoes with high amounts of electricity snapping within the cone, what they call the tornado. And there have been people who survived being in a tornado where they looked up and then they said all they could see was electrical discharges, like lightning. That's, of course, how the normal person would describe it. So all they could see was lightning. Amazing situation, and that is once again because these are the discharge of the vertical electric field of Earth. And standard science says, oh, tornadoes are because two clouds rub together. Well, excuse me. When you see tornadoes, some of the biggest F5 tornadoes have been out of a clear blue sky. And of course, there again, that's what the Russians were very interested in my work, because they didn't understand this. How could you have something like as powerful as a tornado form and really nothing to show for the energy source? What's creating this tremendous amount of energy? Because in the thermodynamics world, if you took a tornado or a hurricane or any water spout, any kind of cyclonic storm, if you took away the power source, they would dissipate in a matter of seconds. And you can see that sometimes with tornadoes. They kind of run their course and they start to dissipate because the vertical electrical current is no longer supporting them. The energy source that's causing them is no longer there. But if you took any hurricane or cyclonic storm in general, and you took away the power source and all of a sudden it just stopped, it would dissipate very, very quickly, even if their winds were 150 miles an hour, because that's the natural state of entropy. That's what energetic systems do, is they dissipate. They don't become more organized. And that's one of the flaws with the explanation that hurricanes form from warm water. It's impossible to form an energetic system from just a pool of warm water. It's absurd. It breaks every law of thermodynamics ever invented. And I also want to just make a comment here, because from what I've heard, I got some feedback from listeners who listen to this show on shortwave, is that last week there was some disturbances and the sun has been relatively active and affecting the ionosphere of Earth, and of course that's what shortwave bounces off of. It's kind of like a mirror surrounding Earth, an electromagnetic mirror, and that's what shortwave is carried on as it circumvents the globe so that you can listen to this show any place on the planet. But the solar storms affect the electrical makeup of planet Earth, and it was affecting this show last week, from what I understand. And of course, there's nothing you can do about that. It's just the way it is. There's electromagnetic radiation from the radio show is permeating the atmosphere, and at the same time, you're getting interference from multiple other sources. So something has got to give. Okay, I want to spend a number of minutes here talking about how big the universe is. And it's really unbelievable. And all you can say is that the human mind, you know, you look at this issue of the James Webb telescoping is discovering these galaxies that are fully developed 13 billion light years away, you know, near the edge of the Big Bang. The end result is that the human brain cannot fathom these distances, the amount of matter in the universe. You just can't. It's like a dream, kind of. It's not something your brain can really understand. Or it's like infinities. There was, when I was in college, one of my math courses that I had a double major, math and physics. So I had a complete major in mathematics and a complete major in physics. And one of the courses in mathematics was the George Cantor was a theoretical mathematician who studied infinities. And it kind of goes like this, that if you have a counting infinity, it would be like 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 counting numbers, and you count all the way up to infinity, that's one kind of infinity. But if you took 1 and 2 in between those two numbers, just 1 and 2 in between those, there's an infinite number of real numbers. And you could never discover them all, but that's a different level of infinity because counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, that's an infinity, but you have many, many more numbers in between 1 and 2 or 0 and 1 than you do for the counting numbers. And so that's another level of infinity. Then you have infinities such as the following. Say you have a tree. Okay, and that tree grows up, it has a plant, or it has a crop of seeds that fall to the ground, and then each one of those seeds then grows, and then they get big, and their leaves and their seeds fall to the ground, giving rise to more trees, and pretty soon you have an infinite number of trees. But it's, once again, a different infinity. Because it's growing, it's like a growth based on every single seed that's out there grows another tree, but that tree grows thousands, maybe tens of thousands of offspring, and each one of those then develops thousands and thousands of offspring. And so it's this multiplication of trees or plants that gives you a different level or a different understanding of infinity. Okay, so what if you add, say you have two rows of numbers, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 in one row, and 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 in another row. Okay, now say you start adding these together. 1 plus 1 is equal to 2. And, okay, that gives you an entirely third set of infinity. Are there three infinities? Are there, you know. So anyway, George Cantor went through a study and classified infinities and gave them understanding, which was a big thing in mathematics, because each one of these mathematical steps gives a level of understanding that was not there before. Okay, so that gives you a feeling for infinity. What is an infinity? It's just, you can't count that far. The prime number works that I work on, there are an infinite number of prime numbers. But what does that really mean? Are there fewer prime numbers in infinity than counting numbers? Well, it looks like that, but, you know, what's the difference in infinity? Anyway, applying this set of concepts to the universe, the current James Webb telescope, big telescope in the infrared, is seeing things that were never seen before, entire galaxies. And so it's what I said all along. As you build bigger telescopes, you're going to see more and more of the same thing. There's the whole idea that it began in a Big Bang and this, all the matter in the universe was in something the size of a pinhead or smaller, doesn't make any sense at all. So with observation, with the James Webb telescope, what you see is literally to the, as far as you can see with a telescope. And if we could build a bigger, better telescope, we're going to see more of the same out there. We're going to see more galaxies. We're going to see, you know, more stars. The stars make up the galaxy. And we're just going to see more of the same. And so trying to understand this from a perspective of being on Earth on this little speck of dust out in the middle of nowhere in one galaxy when we know there are trillions of galaxies, it's beyond comprehension. The human mind, it's beyond comprehension that the human mind simply cannot comprehend this. And so that's where you realize, too, that, you know, we as human beings, we have a very limited time frame that we are here looking at this planet and living on this planet. And people say, oh, we evolved here and, all of this came out of nothing. There's a much bigger story to be told. But the end result is that the human mind simply can't grasp this. And so when George Cantor did his work on infinities, he tried to put it into perspective. But you still can't truly understand infinity. It's bigger, no matter how big you count, or say that take all of the grains of sand on planet Earth, or all the grains of sand and all the lakes in our galaxy. These are finite numbers. There is a number, it's a finite number, and compared to infinity, it's a small number. And so any number you can conceive of is a relatively small number compared to infinity. So when mathematicians say do a proof, and they come up with something that looks good for a certain set of numbers within a certain boundary, okay, that's great. But mathematicians want to know a proof that spans all the way to infinity. And the human mind just cannot comprehend that. Like I say, we can put boundary conditions, we can imagine counting numbers or different types of infinity, but you still cannot understand infinity. And so with astronomy or astrophysics, whatever, cosmology, or various names, the question is, how big is the universe? And it's okay to say we don't know. That's one of the biggest things, one of the biggest phrases that is never said in science or in mathematics, is that we don't know. It's always like, well, if we just did this, we would know more. And no, at a certain point, you have to realize that the human brain has limitations, our ability to understand. Even if you're a well-trained mathematician, you understand what infinity is, and nobody really can. But anyway, back to what I have always said about astronomy, discovering more and more as we get bigger and bigger telescopes looking farther and farther out into space, you're going to find more of the same. And that flies in the face of this idea of the universe beginning in a Big Bang. But understand that the Big Bang universe cosmology is atheist science, because they have to replace God. They can't believe that there was a creator or that there's a higher entity out there. They just can't do that. Their ego, this is an ego thing. They just believe, I've seen scientists say that, they were interviewed and they say, what's going to happen to you after you die? And they just say, oh no, you rot away and you go away and that's the end of it. Like, huh? They don't understand that they have a spirit, they've never learned to communicate with that spirit. And I imagine if you were the creator and you created somebody and they didn't acknowledge you, you'd probably say, okay, then that's what you believe, that's what you get. When you die, you're just going to go away. And that's the end of you. So that you got your wish, so to speak. You wished your eternal existence away. To put this into perspective, however, you look at all of the matter, all the material in the universe, vast amounts of material, and you come back to the humans. And Camus and these philosophers always had to struggle with this. What is the meaning of life? Is there value? And they would struggle with this. But it's actually very simple, that all you have to do is recognize that you are, first of all, a being with recognition of that there is a universe. You can look up. Your dog doesn't look up and look at the stars at night. Your cat does not. Your cow doesn't. The monkeys in the jungle don't. They are busy eating bananas. They, simply react to their environment. But the human being is a very different entity. I wouldn't say animal. A very different entity with a consciousness, with a spirit that goes along with the body. And the person has to understand their importance. And so every person is different. Every person has different values, has different attributes that make them different, and talents. Not everybody has the same talents. And don't tell that Shh, be quiet, don't tell that to the educational institutions who want everybody to come out looking exactly the same. When they say diversity, that's based on skin color, not who you are or how you think or that you're an individual person. It really means make everybody the same. That's what diversity really means. I was in education for a good portion of my life as a student and about 10 years teaching university. And it just slays me to see these universities. You go to their homepage and there's all these different kids of, you know, different ethnic groups or whatever, different skin color, whatever. And that's diversity. Oh my goodness, they're diverse. They're all taught to be the same mentally. There's no challenge. There's no critical thinking. Nothing. So anyway, I'm sorry for getting off track there. But regarding the universe, and then you reflect back on us and this minuscule amount of matter that makes up your being. But the real situation is that every person is extremely important. Very important, because you are the ones that can turn around and look at the universe and just stand there in awe and worship the Creator. And that's what it's all about, recognizing the Creator, that's all, and saying thank you for giving. You know, in Roman mythology and Greek mythology, the Greek gods were always very jealous of man because man had a body and the gods did not. The gods did not have a body, and so they were very jealous of humans. And that's kind of a way of telling people that they had value, much more than the gods themselves. And so that was the mythology. I'm talking about the gods of the Greek and Roman pantheon. But interesting, the way they viewed the that relationship between the gods and man, because man was better because he had a body. But once again, looking at how immense the universe is and how and all of the, you know, the stars and the planets and everything else are following the laws of physics, whatever those are, and in a certain order, etc. But man is the only one that can really change things. Man is the only one that can change his environment. Apart from birds that maybe make a nest or something like that, man can create artwork, can appreciate artwork, can appreciate music, can appreciate all kinds of beautiful things in the world, can appreciate the animals, and man is the only one that can do that. That's why the animals look at man with respect, because they know that man is different. They recognize that. And all animals, no matter what their level, they understand that man is different, and there's something a higher level about man than all the rest of the animals. All the animals understand that and respect it. Very interesting. So instead of trying to understand the immense dimensions in complexity of the universe, in fact, the Native Americans talked about this also, is that they worshipped the entity and they lived in the entity that you would call God or Creator or whatever the term that you want to use, that they were very thankful because they were given everything they needed to live a life. And it wasn't always the easiest life, but it was a gift. It was a gift. And I wanted to talk a little bit about Saturn's ring. I'm running short on time here, just a couple minutes left. But the Saturn's rings are a great example of a beautiful structure in nature. You know, it's when they were very first discovered, they were considered to be, you know, one of the most amazing features, and they still are. They're very complicated. I've talked the last couple of weeks about their structure. The structure of the rings of Saturn and how many other planets and stars have rings like this. Our own sun has a ring. It's called the zodiacal disk. And very similar to Saturn's rings, although it's made primarily of heavy atoms like iron that are very close to the sun, but you can see that ring a couple times of a year coming off of the horizon. And before sunrise and after sunset, on a very, because you can see right along the ring plane itself of the sun, the zodiacal disk, and you can actually see it above the horizon. Like I say, before sunrise and after sunset on a particular day of the year. Okay, so I wanted to talk a little bit about my homepage, which has finally been completed. And of course, there's always little things that pop up that have to be corrected, and like any web page, but 99.999% is done. So go visit the web page. This is my main web page that's been around for decades and decades, jmcanniescience.com. But the short URL that you should remember is just seven letters to get you there, jmccsci.com. That's seven letters. jmccsci.com, and visit it and see all the different things going on there. Also, you can get to the other web pages from that page. You can get to the water filter page, which is JMCC Water Filters, and there's a $350 discount on the best deal, which is our MR5 whole house water filter with the UV sterilizer, something that you should have in your home with the horrendous conditions of water these days. Oh, it's just unbelievable. I talk to people every day that are worried about the water condition and the effects on their health. That's what it comes down to. And so the bottom line price on that right now is $1,750. And we have them in stock, ready to ship. So check that out. And then all of the other things that are there to my education materials. And that's something that I want to stress also. The top menu on the webpage, go to educational materials and click on that. And there's some drop-down menus. Go check those out. All of my books, CDs, DVDs, lecture series, the education package, which is hundreds and hundreds of lectures that took years to build up, and that's all available. And I encourage parents especially to check this out, and parents to educate themselves and then also educate their K-12 university students as to the real workings of the science world. You get a real education there relative to science. And I'm out of time, so we will talk to you next week. This is James McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.